The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Shell and my guests today are Bill Wasik, editor at Wired Magazine, and Monica Murphy, a veterinarian. They are the co-authors of Rabid, a cultural history of the world's most diabolical virus. Great to have both of you here.
Thanks
Great to be
us.
Here.
So it looks like as a species that we've been dealing with rabies for almost as long as we've had the written word. So what are the earliest mentions of it?
Well, yeah, back to Sumerian and Akkadian times, we have references to rabies. So in the laws of Eshnunna, which were a precursor of the Code of Hammurabi, there's actually a stipulation about what you have to pay if your dog becomes rabid and kills somebody. There are incantations against rabies and different spells that people would cast to try to get rid of it. There are, you know, various prophecies that rabies is involved. So it really, you know, in our earliest writings, we have this sort of vibrant presence of rabies as a bugbear in animal populations, specifically the dog.
But since no one knew what caused it at that point, it seems like it was described as more of a demonic possession in some cases, right?
Well, yeah, it was often lumped in with things like snake bites or poisonous animal bites. But it's true also that, you know, like all sorts of diseases, it was seen as a supernatural force that needed to be dealt with, you know, with some sort of supernatural remedy.
So when we're talking about those earliest writings, how can we be sure that rabies is really what they're describing rather than some other rage or fury or something with that similar language?
I'm not an Assyriologist, as they call the people who study that stuff. And so in writing about stuff, we relied on the judgment of people who study it. You know, some of them are pretty suggestive of a disease that comes from dogs in particular, which would, you know, would really point to rabies. In one of them, for example, it says some kind of an incantation that would say, may the dog's bite not leave its semen in the wound, and may the bite not produce puppies. So the idea that the bite would create this malevolent thing in the person was pretty clear from the text.
And what about and I'm probably going to mangle this, the Samhita? First of all, what was that? And what did it have to say about rabies?
Yeah, so one of the most interesting ancient texts about medical texts about rabies is this thing called the Susruta Samhita. And you know, the lineage of this text is actually a little bit confusing because this is the founding text of Ayurveda, the sort of the traditional Indian medical tradition. And by reputation, it's ascribed to this figure Susruta, who was the founder of Indian medicine. He's best known in the history of medicine actually for his incredible surgical techniques. He left, you know, writings about these elaborate surgeries, including surgeries of the eye, which are extremely complicated. He's believed to have done a very good nose job. So the Susruta Samhita is the collected texts that are ascribed to Susruta. The problem is that, you know, some of the wisdom is believed to have come from a predecessor to Susruta, and then meanwhile it was edited by people after the fact. So it's impossible to know exactly when everything in this text came from. But Susruta himself is believed to have lived, I think it was around the first or second century, I believe it was AD. And so, you know, it's in the context of this medical text, there is a very, very good for the ancient times description of rabies and what death from rabies is like. It talks about hydrophobia, which we can talk a little bit more about, but is this distinctive symptom of rabies in humans, which is a revulsion, to water. It talks a little bit about rabies treatments, most of which, as with all rabies treatments, are completely useless. But it's still, for the time, you know, even more than in the Greek tradition, is a very impressive medical description of rabies.
Well, you talked about so much of this, the mentions of rabies across a historical span. Now, is rabies exceptional in that way? Are there other illnesses that are mentioned that far back? so specifically?
I have medical training, and very often our studies begin with at least a roundabout mention of the history of the disease. And it does seem that the ancients have been writing about many diseases going way, way back to when they began writing. But what sets rabies apart is, you know, rabies is a disease we get from animals. So many of our diseases ultimately have their origins in animal populations. But rabies was the one that, going back to the ancients, that was really apparent to the folks who were thinking and writing about rabies. And so unlike a disease like measles, say, that maybe isn't quite as ancient as rabies, but it's it goes way back and people have written about it. The writing explicitly ties rabies to a disease in animal species, whereas measles is and still is today thought of as a human disease. Only people who are pretty academic about disease think about something like measles as something that ultimately maybe way, 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 way back when had its origin in an animal population.
Well, and you wrote that it could be due to our species' kind of special relationship with dogs.
Just to sort of amplify what Monica said, I think that one of the things that makes rabies distinct in the medical literature throughout history is that there's no mistaking it for any other disease, because
right.
you very vividly see the illness in the dog, and you see that illness pass into humans. And, you know, it's absolutely true that part of our terror of rabies throughout the ages is due to the fact that it's coming not just from an animal, but coming from the sort of most loyal and close, you know, almost familial animal to us, the dog. And it's also true that the closeness of dogs to humans is part of what made rabies so effective of a pathogen, because, you know, it had the animals live so close to us that when one of them becomes rabid, then, you know, there's a very, very good chance that they're going to succeed in infecting a human being.
But now, human relationships with dogs really differed by culture, though, and by class, and over time, correct?
You know, to overgeneralize a bit, in ancient texts, in general, you often tend to see rabies referred to as, you know, in ancient Greek, for example, you'll have the same word lissa that means rabies also appearing in Homer, appearing in various tragedies, to mean this kind of animal anger that descends upon people. The sense that rabies almost has a place in the order of things, that it's analogous to, or even, you know, literally the same as, this kind of savage anger that can descend upon human beings. And what's interesting, when you see the in the Christian era, and this is linked, you know, possibly to the fact that there's such a dark view of dogs in the Bible, both testaments of the Bible, that you start to see references to rabies as much more of a kind of almost a demonic possession, you know, this kind of thing from this thing of pure evil that can take somebody over. And so I do think that that distinction is related in a certain way to different views of the dog.
So some people definitely did see the dog-human connection, but not everyone. What were some of the other explanations for rabies? Because there seemed to be a lot of variety.
Well, so the question of how the dogs get rabies is a really interesting controversy. Yes, there was a lot of weird folk wisdom about how the dogs got rabies. And this is especially true in the 19th century, when, you know, a lot of people resisted the idea of contagion, because this was the sort of dawn of the era of pet keeping, when people would feel like they had their dogs under control, even if they didn't really know exactly what their dogs were doing at any given point in time. They would feel like they had their dogs under control. And so, especially if, you know, someone from the, you know, upper or middle classes had a dog and the dog became rabid, they would often look to other weird explanations for how the dog could have gotten rabies other than that it had gotten bitten. And so yeah, in around the 1830s, you have this weird theory developing that the fact that the pet dog was not allowed to, you know, gratify its sexual urges at will was actually the cause of rabies. The rabies would spontaneously generate in these dogs. And then, you know, if the dogs bit the people, then the people would get rabies and die. But yeah, during the 19th century, you had this very weird idea about how dogs were getting rabies.
And in people during the same time period, although, you know, throughout history, the relationship between the dog bite and the development of rabies was pretty clear. There was an idea circulating that rabies may be a hysterical condition, one right. that results from sort of the psychic distress of having endured a dog bite. So that was a controversy that flared up in the middle of the 19th century, but was more or less settled by the germ theory and the work of Louis Pasteur.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Monica Murphy and Bill Wasik, the co-authors of Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. So, Bill, you mentioned hydrophobia. So maybe let's talk about the symptoms of rabies, because some of the explanations for rabies were sort of based on those symptoms.
The symptoms of rabies in the human being are quite varied, but if we can make generalizations about how signs of rabies develop in a person, we'd say that days to weeks to months or even longer after suffering a rabid bite, often after the wound is healed, the person is likely to feel some combination of malaise, flu-like illness, as well as some tingling or pain associated with the site of the rabid bite. So if the person was bitten on the hand, they might feel some twitchy discomfort there where the bite had happened weeks before. Over time, the patient is likely to become sort of mentally distressed or deranged, might become what we'd call dysphoric, sort of acting out in a not very rational way and hyper responsive to stimuli around them. And then very frequently, the symptom hydrophobia is seen, not in every case, but in very many of them. And it's quite characteristic of rabies, or specific to the disease. And what happens with hydrophobia is because the patient is having trouble swallowing, although they may be quite thirsty as they're ill, they try to drink and experience a choking-like sensation because of the difficulty swallowing. And after living with this feeling for minutes or hours or days, they develop an actual fear of water. And so historic descriptions of rabid patients might actually describe a fear of water that's far more generalized than just being worried about what will happen if they attempt to take a sip from a cup, a fear of getting into a boat or shaving using water,
right.
Which is kind of interesting in a terribly morbid way.
Right.
The patients they suffer terribly. I recommend against looking up YouTube videos of patients with rabies. It's
too late. My friend.
Pretty awful stuff, and especially given the fact that around the world, in places where rabies is still quite prevalent, it tends to be children disproportionately affected by rabies, and so it's a real tragedy to see a young person affected by a disease as awful as this one, especially because it is almost invariably fatal. The outcome is always horrible.
In its heyday, let's say, how common was rabies before Pasteur, who we'll get to in a bit?
I'm not sure we have good data to answer that question. Rabies, we might compare the frequency of rabies in Europe and the Americas in the pre-Pasteur era to the, you know, global rabies situation now in places where healthcare is not as widely available. But, you know, I think it's important to note that rabies has always loomed disproportionately large in the human imagination. So even though the diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, depending on where you are way more common than rabies as a cause of death, people worry about rabies. Rabies makes headlines. Rabies terrorizes a town when there's an sort of epizootic of rabid dogs running around. So it is something that people think about out of proportion to the incidence of rabies. And then also because it is so fatal. Once you experience the symptoms of rabies, you're going to die. And that is unique. Rabies is the most fatal disease by that measure. And that is part of what makes it so horrible and has people so worried, both in history and today.
So how was it treated, again, pre-discovery of germ theory? Because there are some particularly interesting ones that you mentioned. Interesting and disturbing, I should of course say.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that's so, you know, from the perspective of the sort of early medical imagination, because there's such a long period that happens between the bite and the rabies infection, and also because, I mean, even without treatment, only a fraction, I think the estimate that we read pre-Pasteur was about 1 in 5, only about 1 in 5 bites left untreated from an actually rabid animal will wind up resulting in a human rabies infection. It allowed a lot of early doctors to believe that they had found a successful treatment for rabies. And so, you know, one of the sort of funnest parts of the book was compiling all of these just ridiculous supposed rabies treatments and rabies cures from ancient medical authors, because, you know, reasonably speaking, you know, you try something and the person doesn't get rabies, and clearly the dog had rabies and therefore you have a rabies treatment. So, it's quite a set of things when it turned out that none of them were doing anything.
Well, actually, one of the most interesting ones, in my opinion, was the inserting into the bite wound the ashes from the hair of the tail of the dog that bit you.
That's right, which is compiled in Pliny the Elder, and is the source of our you know, apocryphal hangover cure, the hair of the dog that bit you.
I love that. And also I do have to mention the one involving the chicken anus. You put the chicken anus, live chicken anus, I should clarify, on the wound. And then I guess if the chicken gets sick, then you have rabies. Fascinating.
Yeah.
So rabies obviously was basically horrific. So horrific, in fact, that you argue that there's a link between vampire and werewolf lore and rabies.
If you think about the vampire and the werewolf and the zombie, right, you have some very strange saliva-borne infections that cause, you know, the transference of this sort of animal madness from a sick creature into a healthy human being who begins to develop those symptoms themselves. You know, I don't necessarily believe that rabies is sort of the ultimate cause of those myths, but I do think that there is this, that they stem, you know, and the fact that so many of our horrors are so rabies-like, I think stems from this sort of same underlying anxiety, which is about the sort of the animal, kind of animal fury sort of coming from safe places and overtaking us. But with rabies, you know, it's real life. It's not a horror movie.
Obviously, the werewolf link is fairly clear. But that could be where the vampire as bat idea comes from.
You know, in some ways, though, the link actually went the other direction, which was that the vampire bat, tales of the vampire bat, were coming out of Latin America sort of at the same point that the vampire myth was incubating in Europe. And so the vampire bat was often cited. It was these sort of same kind of this sort of murky stew of tales coming out at the same time. And what you find is that in the earliest vampire tales in the sort of late 18th century, you often have vampires associated with the dog, and that then by the sort of mid to late 19th century, the vampire begins to be associated more with the bat, and that's sort of codified with Dracula. But yeah, all of this stuff is you know, kind of circulating at the same time.
We have a question from Klaus.
Do we know what animal first infected humans with rabies?
Well, historically, rabies has been associated with the dog, and Although now we know that there are many wildlife vectors for rabies who can efficiently transmit rabies virus to humans. And we also furthermore know that the bat is probably the progenitor strain that bats gave rabies to dogs, and dogs, then have been given rabies to people over time. I think it's actually hard to get a sense for the epidemiologic importance of wildlife rabies in places where dog rabies is prevalent, is happening, because dog rabies is so much more dangerous. Dogs live so close to humans, and over a normal course of events, a dog might bite a human defending its food or its puppies. It's hard for a person to know exactly what to make of a dog bite in every case. Whereas if a raccoon runs out of the woods and jumps on your shoulder, bites your neck, you know that's abnormal, and you're likely in a developed country anyway to get treatment for that and avert getting diseased. Dog rabies, though, you know, the infections can come from all sorts of sort of ambiguous situations where dogs and humans are living in close society. And so you don't see any mention of wildlife rabies other than canids, like wolves, in the historic literature. It's more or less a contemporary phenomenon, the recognition of wildlife rabies.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy, the co-authors of Rabid, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today we're talking about rabies. My guests are veterinarian Monica Murphy and Wired editor Bill Wasik, who are the authors of the book Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. So let's skip ahead a bit. We're now at the point where very few people know anyone who's ever contracted rabies, and even the word rabid is used to describe Justin Bieber fans rather than the actual illness. And yes, I stole your joke. It was a good joke. So how did we get here?
I guess we have to thank Louis Pasteur for this turn of events. Until Pasteur, rabies terrorized Europe, Americas, as well as Asia and Africa. These days, in developed parts of the world where medical care is widely available, we don't see a lot of human rabies because of Pasteur's vaccines as applied both to the human being and the dog.
So why did he pick rabies exactly? Because it didn't kill as many people as other diseases.
No, it didn't. And Louis Pasteur, at the point that he chose rabies to work on, had already developed a couple of very effective veterinary vaccines, one against chicken cholera and another against anthrax. And he felt very strongly about his methodology, which was essentially you isolate the organism causing the disease, you reproduce it in the laboratory, and attenuate it through a variety of physical and chemical processes, and use that to immunize a population against subsequent disease. He felt like this method would have broad application with human illnesses as well. He was right, but he wanted to, for his first human disease to work on, choose a disease that would grab headlines, that would get a lot of attention, and make widely known the science of the Pasteur laboratory, so that it might catch on and do the most good. At least that's how I like to think of it. I'm a fan of Pester.
We're all a fan. But that's the thing. He's responsible for so many medical breakthroughs, but he really put himself in harm's way with rabies. His research was interesting.
Unlike anthrax and chicken cholera and diseases that Pasteur had worked with before, rabies is caused by a virus, which means he couldn't grow it in a test tube or on a plate. And so he actually had to grow the virus in living tissue, in animals. And his laboratory at one time was full of rabid rabbits, rabid dogs, and others, as he, you know, tried to create a method for attenuating the virus and creating a vaccine that would be effective against rabies. And so he and his colleagues would actually do daring feats like harvesting rabid saliva from a raging dog in order to, you know, have the infectious principle to transmit the rabies, you know, to yet another animal in order to attempt attenuation. And it's dangerous and fascinating stuff. And really, I mean, the daring came not only from the physical danger he and his colleagues were in, but the fact that they did all this without being able to see the pathogen. I mean, we were in the age of microscopy at this point, and with diseases like anthrax, you could not only grow up the organism in a beaker, you could look at it under the microscope and see what you were working with. But they pursued this dangerous work with tremendous faith that there was an infectious principle, even though with the technology of the day, it was invisible to them. So it was scary yet sort of ungovernable stuff, the rabies virus, since it was too small to be seen with light microscopy. It didn't grow on a plate. It was more or less invisible to them.
Now, people were fairly open to acting as human test subjects after things went well with the animals.
Well, I mean, Pasteur was within France already somewhat of a celebrity at this time, and it was widely known that he was working on a rabies vaccine. The sort of point at which he began to use the vaccine on people is still today a subject of controversy, whether it was actually appropriate to use a human test subject at the stage of research he was at. When he did first deploy the rabies virus, or rabies vaccine, rather, to save a person. But, you know, whether by ethical standards of his day or ours, it was the right thing to do. It turned out to be an effective thing to do in that from its first use, it was credited with saving life.
I am under the impression that every time a new vaccine is developed, the anti-vaccination people immediately came out of the woodwork. So was that not the case with rabies?
Oh, it was the case with rabies. It goes back to Jenner, anti-vaccine, populism. There was a pre-existing group of anti-vaccinists ready to take on the Pasteur innovation at the point that he invented it. People were angry about the use of the vaccine. There are some famous illustrations of the day that show, the comics sort of portraying Pasteur as sort of an evildoer who's putting animal into people, kind of stuff.
He really was a brilliant science marketer.
So, and that goes back to your question about why he chose rabies. I mean, he knew it would make headlines, and he made sure it made headlines. From the first use of the vaccine, which was in a adorably innocent young boy from the eastern part of France who had been attacked on his way home from school by the grocer's dog, and judged to be extremely likely to die without treatment. Pasteur held up this still living boy several months later, for all the world to see, I think Pasteur was a clever enough scientist to know that this anecdote didn't necessarily prove his case all by itself, but in the public imagination it did, and he made sure as many people as possible heard about it.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Monica Murphy and Bill Wasik, the co-authors of Rabid. So where do we stand with rabies now? How many people get infected and how many people die because of it?
The current estimate is about 55,000 people a year from the WHO. But it's actually really difficult, you know, to derive that number because the vast majority of rabies cases are happening in Asia and Africa, in countries where, you know, access to medical care is really the issue. And so, you know, the question of just how many people are dying is it's somewhat difficult to know.
And we should mention that the rate of infection equals the rate of death because survival is beyond exceptional. Virtually everybody who develops symptoms of rabies will die of rabies several days later.
So that's the key with the vaccine, is getting to the people before they actually start showing symptoms.
Before they develop symptoms. And it's a great vaccine in that you can use it after exposure. So although some people who are in what are considered high-risk occupations, like mine, receive pre-exposure vaccination, that is rabies vaccine against some future exposure, most folks who receive the rabies vaccine receive it because they had an exposure to an animal that was judged to be dangerous, a known rabid animal or a suspicious animal, or just an animal who's kind of an unknown quantity. And so the vaccine is very effective in that situation, preventing infection from taking hold of the patient. And so we're very, very lucky to have it. The vaccine is used many multiples of times more than the infection and the death rate for rabies. You know, all over the world, people are receiving vaccine to stave off what would otherwise be a fatal infection.
We have an email question from Sanovia.
Why does treating rabies take so many injections?
Well, you know, the protocol for rabies vaccine has changed a lot over time. And, you know, I remember it being sort of common knowledge on the schoolyard that if you got bit by a rabid dog, you'd have to get 20 shots in the stomach, which has not been the case for a long, long time. Yeah, the protocol is at this point down to 4 shots of vaccine over a 2-week period. It might get shorter still. We'll see. That's an area of active research because the easier you make it for people to get vaccinated, the more likely they're going to follow through on the entire series they need to prevent infection. These days we use separate injections of immunoglobulin to create immunity right away. And I guess if we're reluctant to drop the protocol even lower than what it is today in terms of number of shots and so on, it's because rabies is really fatal and we don't want to make a mistake. The people who are judged to need vaccine, we really need them to develop immunity because it's an awful disease.
Here's a question from Dallas.
If rabies is 100% fatal to the organisms it infects, how does it manage to persist?
The question of whether it is 100% fatal to all organisms it infects is, I guess, not entirely a closed question. It may be that some species, in some circumstances, can occasionally survive exposure, if not a brain infection with rabies. The more important issue is the rabid animal before it dies of rabies is stimulated by the rabies virus itself to rage and bite and make sure there's a high likelihood of contact and a high likelihood that the virus is going to be passed on to a new victim. And I want to go over that one more time because it's actually really important about rabies. Rabies gets inside the brain of its victim and it affects the limbic system, which is sort of the primal part of the brain that controls rage and fear, that whole fight or flight thing. It gets in there and it causes the infected animal to become more likely to bite, either out of fear or anger at a subsequent victim. And meanwhile, it is reproducing itself avidly in the salivary glands of the host so that bite is very, very likely to be infectious. The rabies virus just needs to reach a nerve ending in a new victim in order to make its crawl up to a new nervous system and a new opportunity. So the the vaccine actually is one of these, you know, parasites or infecting agents that alters the behavior of the host to propagate itself and reach new victims. And so it's scary stuff. Even though ultimately that animal is going to die, it's quite likely that before it dies, it's going to go on a bitey rampage and cause new animals to be infected.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned that because that brings me to something I really find fascinating that you wrote about, a very controversial rabies treatment.
And, you know, leading up to the past decade, rabies was widely believed without exception to be 100% fatal in humans. The infected person who develops the symptoms of rabies is sure to die. And that was sort of dogmatic. It would be on your medical board exam. It was in textbooks. And so it really was a historical situation when in 2004, a doctor in Milwaukee faced with a case of rabies in a teenage girl decided to try something a little new, induced a coma in his patient, and actually saw her through treatment and ended up with a live girl. She survived rabies. She went on to be, you know, a fully functional human being. And it's a great story. I mean, it's everyone was delighted to learn that number one, rabies is conceivably survivable. Kind of broke the 100% rule, although I think we still believe that this young woman and others who we've discovered have survived since are exceptional. You know, secondly, it opens hope that, you know, there's a specific treatment that might improve the likelihood of survival. And so this induced coma treatment invented by Dr. Willoughby in Milwaukee has received a lot of attention and has been repeated many times in an attempt to see further success. Success has been mixed over subsequent years. And so, you know, we try to keep up with Dr. Willoughby and how many people have used his protocol. He maintains a website about it and folks can upload their stories and data about subsequent cases. And I think when we last checked in, he had 40, perhaps a couple more than 40 attempts using the protocol, and several survivors. But amongst those survivors were some cases that even though the patient came out of the coma, they didn't do well. They died of complications or they were severely and permanently disabled. Another little girl, though, in the United States is now on the list of survivors, joining the girl in Milwaukee. She's from California, like me and Bill. She's from upstate, and she survived rabies with an induced coma just about a year and a half ago, I guess. And I met her, and she looks great. So that's very exciting. But meanwhile, there's ongoing skepticism in the rabies research community about whether this treatment really works or whether what recent events point to is the fact that maybe rabies is more survivable than we realized and our ability to detect survivors is improving. And so, you know, maybe it's nothing more than a sort of coincidence that survival is happening you know, within the context of this protocol invented by Dr. Willoughby. And to sort of add another little interesting element to the mix, there has now been a report of one survivor who survived with no advanced treatment at all, no Milwaukee protocol, no coma, no advanced care of any sort. She was treated as an outpatient and an inpatient in a Texas hospital and did test positive for rabies and, you know, and apparently got better. She was lost to follow-up, but when she was last seen, sort of checking in at an emergency room for some follow-up care, she was doing quite well. So, you know, it's an ongoing controversy. You know, are these young people surviving rabies because of the protocol or despite it? If rabies isn't 100% fatal, how fatal is it really? I think we still believe it's you know, above 99% fatal, which is still very, very deadly, and would make it the deadliest disease. But it's but the very fact that we know about survivorship at this point does change how rabies is likely to be handled in the hospitals in the developed world, for sure, and raises a lot of kind of distressing questions about how rabies, you know, should be handled around the world, given that you know, it's pretty resource intensive to take care of a patient using anything like the Milwaukee protocol, and the where most of the rabies cases are happening. There are some real big challenges in the health delivery system, you know, such that people aren't getting the vaccine they need to prevent rabies, and so it's tricky stuff.
We have an email from Jasmine.
Are there any mammals that are immune to rabies?
No. No mammals are immune to rabies. All mammals are susceptible to rabies. There are several wildlife vector species that seem to be pretty good at transmitting rabies amongst themselves and to other dead-end hosts around them. And that basically has to do with how long they survive with rabies and how bitey they are, you know, how good they are at getting rabies into a new victim. And so rabies has adapted itself to several hosts. In North America, bats are the biggest, but also raccoons, skunks, and foxes, and to some extent coyotes. And in these species, rabies, you know, and the vector species have sort of an arrangement, I guess you might say, an evolutionary arrangement in which the infected animal, you know, is able to get around for a while with the disease, infect some new individuals before succumbing, and that's what makes them good vectors.
We have time for one last question, and only because I really like it. This is from Karen.
How accurate has the portrayal of rabies in Old Yeller and other movies been?
Well, you know, in Old Yeller, I guess it's fairly accurate. I mean, the dog gets bit by a rabid animal, and they decide, unlike in the book, by the way, where they just kill the dog straight away, once it's been bit by a rabid animal, they corral the dog to wait and see if it becomes rabid. I can't remember how long they corral it. The dog might become rabid a little bit too fast. That's a common problem in portrayal of rabies. But yeah, and then the dog gets vicious and they shoot it. So yeah, I think that you know, the depictions in Old Yeller and To Kill a Mockingbird, like, they do a pretty good job. Their Eyes Were Watching God is a little bit you know, weird, the way that the human case of rabies is portrayed. But you know, it's it really is a subject that creates a lot of fascination in popular culture.
I'll mention again, though, the portrayal of vaccines. I think many people still believe that the vaccine protocol for rabies is quite elaborate and involves shots to the abdomen, which has not been the case for some decades in this country. So I think, as someone mentioned to me recently, I haven't seen it, but there was an episode of House that featured rabies. And, you know, so set in the present day, and the vaccine protocol involved abdominal injections and many shots. So it's a little alarming to hear about, but
you're doing your part.
Yeah,
right now.
That's right.
And thanks very much to both of you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having
us. Happy to be here.
You can find links to Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy, the authors of Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk with postdoctoral research assistant and lecturer, Dr. Elizabeth White. And we'll be talking about using video games to help patients with autism process facial cues. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at science stories driving headlines and causing conversation. We'll speak to particle physicist James Pinfold about recent experiments that cast doubt on a possible explanation for dark matter. Molecular pharmacologist David Kroll returns to explain the connection between high caffeine energy drinks and health complications. And we'll get some insight on the nuanced reality of gender expression from Joel Baum, Director of Education and Training at Gender Spectrum. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Dr. Elizabeth White. She's a psychology postdoctoral research assistant and lecturer at the Pennsylvania State University, where she works in the Laboratory of Developmental Neuroscience. She studies face processing abilities in adolescents with autism spectrum disorders. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Now, you're here to talk about a crowdfunding project that you've started, but first I want to talk a little bit about your work. So, of course, autism is a very big and very complicated topic, but one of the things that many people with autism experience is trouble understanding faces. Can you talk about that?
So the research lab I work in has been looking at how kids and adolescents with autism understand sort of facial expressions like being happy or sad, and also how they remember the faces of other people. You know, in your everyday life, you have to remember who the other kids in the class are and what their names are. And if you, you know, mix up Tom with Andy and call him by the wrong name, that might be, you know, a problem because they might not, you know, appreciate being called the wrong name. So for the research that we're doing, we look at neuroscience. So how does your brain sort of process information expressed on faces? We've been working on projects related to face processing and how that relates to social skills. And we've been doing sort of more recently intervention research to try to improve, you know, face recognition abilities and processing information from faces.
Am I understanding this correctly? People with autism spectrum disorder or on the autism spectrum disorder basically see individual features, not whole faces?
I mean, they can see the whole face, but they tend to focus on parts of things instead of the whole thing. You know, typical adults tend to look at a face and process sort of a holistic set of features rather than individual features. And individuals with autism, especially those with more severe face processing symptoms, will sort of focus on recognizing people by their hair or focusing on looking at their mouths and sort of do feature-based processing rather than sort of more holistic processing.
And making eye contact is also a struggle, I understand.
Right. One of the most noticeable symptoms, even in young infants through adults, is sort of problems with being able to sort of make eye contact and maintain eye contact. And some people with autism will say that, you know, looking into someone's eyes is, you know, really like painful, like looking into a light bulb. So while, you know, a typical adult, you know, will enjoy staring longingly into their partner's eyes, someone with autism, you know, may be more comfortable and may sort of process what the person's saying when they're not looking at them. But when you aren't looking at someone you're talking to, you look like you're not listening or you look like you aren't being honest. So that's sort of something that the individuals can sometimes struggle with.
So now you study this in your lab. How do you do that?
The tasks we use present information on computers and have them. The tasks can sometimes be presenting a couple faces and saying, okay, you need to remember these faces later. And so you get some time to learn what the faces look like. And then those go away and you get a face that comes up and says, did you see this person before? Yes or no? And you have to make decisions about sort of the identity of faces in some of the tasks. I've done tasks before where we just ask the kids, you know, is this person happy or sad? Which is not too difficult, but if you take just the eye regions of the faces and say, is this person happy or sad? Now that's a much more difficult task. We also do tasks using neuroimaging technology. So we'll have someone in an MRI scanner and use sort of the powerful magnets of the scanner to measure blood flow in the brain. And so we'll present pictures of sort of human faces with varying expressions and pictures of objects and pictures of cars and pictures of houses. And one of the new tasks that we've added more recently is pictures of animal faces. And so we're finding in our neuroimaging tasks that adolescents with autism, when they're looking at faces, the regions that are active and the network tends to be more object-like, like using more of the regions that would process objects rather than faces, was some of Dr. Scherf's sort of early findings With the Animal Face Project, the five or so kids who have come through the lab more recently are showing more activation in sort of typical face regions for the animal faces more than for the human faces. So we haven't tried this new task with typical populations yet. We ran our first typical adult on the animal face paradigm yesterday to see if larger activation for animal faces is something abnormal in autism or is it something normal. That's sort of like hot off the lab floor data we're like currently analyzing like tomorrow.
Brilliant. Thank you. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Elizabeth White, postdoctoral researcher studying ways to help adolescents with autism spectrum disorders learn to process the information communicated by human faces. The reason why you're studying this is that your lab is working on interventions. So is it possible for a child with autism to learn how to see and interpret faces?
Maybe. There have been a lot of attempts of sort of, you know, helping kids young or older with face processing. A lot of the interventions that they use tend to not be designed super well. And so a lot of the findings are really hit or miss depending on the program. The current intervention that our lab is doing presents cartoon objects to sort of build up some of the neural networks that usually process faces using sort of novel objects. And that seems to have some actual carryovers to the face processing system. And that's the sort of first intervention that we're working on. For our gaming intervention, the animal data we got really surprised us and changed how we were sort of thinking about the project directions. And so we want to make sort of to improve on the interventions using real human faces, trying to figure out what the best approach is to sort of building up that neural network to process the human faces in a better way and changing how we have to be creative and think about that. So we think it's possible to sort of improve face processing abilities if we embed that face training in more social contexts. Because a lot of the face training programs tends to be like our cartoon Griebel one, where we don't actually present faces as a more indirect approach, or the ones that directly use faces tend to have floating heads with no bodies, totally out of context, and you just are presented with face after face after face after face after face in really sort of repetitive ways that may have an impact on social skills and may not. So we want to use the gaming features to be able to make the faces more relevant to doing actions. So you may play a game where, you know, you have to follow the eye gaze of someone to navigate a maze, or you may have to do like an actual communication. So you're communicating with the other character in some meaningful way, and using, you know, the cues from faces to make decisions about, oh, the person's sad, so I need to make them happy before they'll tell me the clue that I need or something like that.
So the focus on then the second part of this, the video game mm-hmm. part, is basically built on the idea that the first part was boring?
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of the autism researchers don't really understand how video games are made, which is also true of Dr. Scherf in my lab, and we have really awesome conversations about the game project where she understands the autism science, but not the gaming piece.
Right.
So it's a really kind of a learning experience in our lab that I've been drawing on sort of my knowledge of games.
Because you actually have quite a background mm-hmm. in gaming yourself, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've played World of Warcraft now for 8 years. And I do sort of video game blogging as well, right? And so I've gotten to sort of play a little bit in my small amounts of free time because I'm a workaholic and I work all the time. But I've sort of found this nice balance of, you know, taking some time away from work to sort of, you know, play my video games. And through that, I've developed kind of a neat skill set of understanding some of the psychology aspects of video games through reading articles and sort of following that literature. So now I'm getting to actually use some of that video game knowledge and some of the background in understanding what makes video games fun to translating that to improving sort of computer-based or iPad or whatever other technologies we can to sort of make fun interventions. Because the current intervention in our lab, they learn these little cartoons. And by the end of it, they're doing thousands of trials that are just yes, no. Like, is this Bob? Yes. Is this Susie? No. Is this John? Yes. And they're just sort of going yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And it's really sort of boring and repetitive. And then at like the end of the day, they get a little video clip that has all the storyline in it. And is like, this is not how you design a computer thing. Like, they do it because we bribe them with money. When if we actually packaged this up and put it on the market, no one would touch it. And so everyone wonders why they have sort of these compliance issues of getting people, you know, to do the training program. But it's like taking your medicine. If your medicine tastes bad, you don't like taking it. If you add a little sugar and some motivation in it and you make it taste like candy, suddenly everyone wants to take your medicine and you're having to hide the cough drops.
I feel like there's a song in there somewhere.
Something like that. So I kind of got together a really neat collaboration between Susie Scherf, who's a fabulous autism researcher, and Josh Smythe from Biobehavioral Health, who has done some video game research. So he's actually done projects where he brought people in the lab and had them play video games and has sort of studied aspects of that. So I got them both in a room together and we're working out how to make sort of an educational game for autism where we can sort of use what we know about the learning pieces that we need and sort of combine it with the gaming pieces that I think we really need. And then so our hope is that we'll be able to sort of improve face processing and social skills if we sort of draw on more sort of creativity.
And then, of course, that is where the internet comes in. You have turned to the intertubes for help because research costs money. So tell us about Rocket Hub.
Rocket Hub is a crowdfunding platform that was primarily built to fund entertainment things. So 100 people come together and donate to build a video game or to fund someone's music album. And a group called the SciFund Challenge partnered with Rocket Hub to get scientists involved in crowdfunding. So SciFund and Rocket Hub together, a couple times a year, they'll do a push where right now I think there's 35 research labs had to take their really confusing science stuff and boil it down to things that average people without a science background could understand. We spend a lot of time going over each other's projects and pulling out all the jargon words. So I don't know what blah, 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 blah means. Please put that in English. Oh, it just means that you're making a video game. All right. Why didn't you just say that? We did sort of a form of peer review on each other's projects and got a feel for what the projects were and how to communicate them. So after about a month of working on designing the projects, we put all 35 research labs posted their crowdfunding stuff on Rocket Hub, and that runs for, I think our projects were about 33 days, where we send out to our social networks and media sites and beyond to sort of tell people about what we're doing. So anyone can go to Rocket Hub and watch the little 3-minute video where we talk about the research we're doing in the lab. And hopefully some of the people who come to the site will throw a couple bucks our way.
What exactly will the funds you're raising help you to do then?
We're going to have a gap of time in funding where our current project is winding down with the sort of cartoon one, and we're trying to ramp up the video game one. So we're sort of looking for funds to get more people to come in the lab to do the animal face task that I talked about earlier, because right now we only have data from 7 adolescents with autism, and we'll have 5 typical adults by the end of the week, but we need to bring in more people who can do that task. So we're looking to sort of get more data on that. And then we're going to use whatever's left over after that to sort of help with equipment needs and such for getting the gaming stuff up and running while we work on sort of getting bigger grant funds to sort of test the game.
Elizabeth, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
There is a link to Dr. Elizabeth White and her crowdfunding project on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, where you can stay up to date on show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.